Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. Well, this broadcast will be featuring Taylor Stripe. He'll be answering your most important questions on instinctive fly fishing. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we are broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Taylor a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and your email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. Content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this show cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Taylor Strite about instinctive fly fishing. Royal Gorge Anglers is a full-service fly shop on the Arkansas River in Canyon City, Colorado. They provide both walk, wade, and float fishing guide service on the Arkansas, South Platte, and several high country ranches. They specialize in fly fishing education and work to assure that everyone taking a trip leaves being a better fly fisher. For the best service and the most fun in the Southern Rockies, visit the folks at Royal Gorge Anglers, the gateway to Southern Colorado. Located conveniently on US 50, only 45 minutes from Colorado Springs. For more information, visit their website at www.royalgorgeanglers.com. That's www.royalgorgeanglers.com. Or call them at 888-994-6743. That's 888-994-6743. Before we introduce Taylor, I'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. And now if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Taylor's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Taylor's most recent edition of Instinctive Fly Fishing, courtesy of Lions Press. And to find out more about the books Lions Press has to offer, you can go to www.lionspress.com. So here's how you can win Taylor's book. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show, and the question would be about something we talked about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and your location using that text box on our homepage, and, you know, be first, be fast. And the first person that gives me the correct answer or answers, if I decide to do a multiple answer question, then we'll win Taylor's book. Well, tonight our guest is Taylor Strite. Taylor was wading the fabled waters of New York's Catskills before he was 10, then tying flies commercially and guiding in his teens. He moved to northern New Mexico in the late 60s, where after several minor careers and lifestyles, opened the Taos Fly Shop. He's guided fly fishermen for 40 years, primarily in New Mexico, but also in the Bahamas and Argentina as well. Guiding is what has paid the bills. There's been no trust fund or endorsements. If the clients don't catch, we don't eat. In 2001, he was unanimously inducted into the Freshwater Fishing Hall of Fame as a legendary guide. He's authored four books, Fly Fishing New Mexico, Man vs. Fish, The Fly Fisherman's Eternal Struggle, and Instinctive Fly Fishing, 1 and 2. He holds fly fishing schools annually and writes and photographs for various magazines and newspapers. He has developed a number of fly patterns, including the Mighty Poundmeister, and he lives in Taos, New Mexico, near his favorite river, the Wild Rio Grande. He works with his son, Nick, in Taos Fly Shop and runs the guiding side of the business. Well, Taylor, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Hi, Roger. How are you?
Good, good. Glad to have you on board. And are you guys still waiting for winter down there?
Yeah, I was telling somebody a couple of days ago that we were going to do something around Christmas, and I said, well, it'll be 90 degrees by Christmas.
It's yeah.
It was 58 or something like that today.
Yeah, I'm at 8,800 feet up in the Rockies here, and it was 60 degrees on my deck today. So, but I hear the snow's coming this weekend, so we need it bad. Well, we've got lots of questions tonight for you, Taylor, and this is kind of fun because we're kind of dipping into a lot of different things here, which kind of is what your book does. So why don't, you know, that's kind of an interesting title for your book, and we did the show with the same title. What is instinctive fly fishing?
Well, good question. It's, you know, I've been asked that a lot, and the truth is that a more accurate title might be uninstinctive fly fishing, because because being a guide, that's what we see a whole lot more of than people kind of naturally taken to it. And so the whole idea of instinctive is that it's a rarity. You know, most people come a little bit kind of at a technical angle often, and we find that people that got their farmers. Yeah, a lot of times we'll ask potential clients what they do for a living, where they're from, and certainly it often has quite a bearing on how well they do in the day.
Mm-hmm. So you said in your book, and I'm just picking this out of there because I thought it was kind of interesting that you had a chapter on fly fishing personalities. And
yes.
When you talk about them in the book, you've got many different in there, but which of these personalities do you see most often on the river? And maybe you can kind of explain them in how guides see us as fly fishers.
Yeah. Well, we've never fished together, so fortunately we can't.
That's probably fortunate for me.
Well,
and you.
And I'm a little bit prepared for that question, because the one I picked out is the analytical fly fisherman. I'm going to quote from what I wrote here, which is, the analytical fly fisherman keeps so busy fiddling with his formulas, strategies, and entomological charts that the simple, straightforward solutions to catching a fish are often overlooked. If, for instance, he can't catch a fish, he should examine the obvious first. Has the fish actually seen the fly? Has the fish seen him? Heck, maybe the fish can't even see. I once approached a client who was casting to a dead trout lying on the bottom of a river. He told me that it wouldn't, quote, take, and was showing the decomposing animal a new fly as I arrived. To first study the condition of such a docile creature might have been the common sense thing to do, but as a cabbie once told me, common sense ain't common. So, you know, we see people kind of, you know, that's a guide's job, is to have people concentrate on really what's important, you know. One of the things that we find immensely important is setting the hook, just simple striking. And, you know, we'll take people fishing who have been fishing all their lives, and we'll get them out nymph fishing, and we'll start yelling, strike, set the hook, quick, faster, you know. And they kind of look at us with this quizzical, you know, like they haven't been striking at all these little nudges and whatever it might be that they've been getting all of their fishing career, perhaps, you know, and so, or striking hard enough. So, you know, just some very common sense things that we really key on guiding that people don't pay that much attention to, perhaps, you know, get involved with other things. But we like to see that hook get set.
Yeah. You know, that seems to always be the call of the guide on the river.
Yeah.
Can hear it up and down the river, you know.
Uh-huh.
But that shows experience on the river. And just hold on. Larry Hull wrote in here on the Internet. He's looking for the register link on today's show. Larry, refresh the page, and then you'll see it. For those other of you looking to register for tonight's drawing, just refresh that home page, and you should see the link show up, because I just fixed that a second ago. Okay. Yeah, so what of the personalities that you came, you know, and I know for the listeners out there, if they get your book, they'll see all these. I think you got 7 or 8 in there. But which one should we strive to be to become a better fly fisher?
Well, I have one called, this ends the chapter, and it's called The Open-Minded Angler. The open-minded angler uses the experience and expertise acquired on his home water elsewhere, but is not a slave to it. All trout streams are different, and if you step into new water with a lot of preconceived notions, you may go fishless. A good example of this occurs when a tailwater fisherman fishes a new trout stream. Because he is used to being surrounded by both fish and fishermen, he is programmed to move at a slow pace. This is inappropriate for a normal trout stream, because a regular freestone stream doesn't hold as many fish as a tailwater. The trout, less pressured in the freestone stream, might take a fly the first time it goes over their head. Consequently, covering lightly fished water quickly is wise. This open-minded angler pays attention to what is going on around him and goes at a relaxed enough pace that he can absorb the subtle hints that nature constantly supplies to the observant. This person also solicits help and advice from others and is willing to learn new things. Yeah, that's the end of the chapter on the fly fishing personality.
What do you think, what's the percentage of people that do approach their fly fishing in that way? Do you find it?
Oh, very few.
Really?
Including me.
Huh.
I think we all get so wound up and obsessed and, you know, kind of a rifle shot mentality that we miss a lot what's going on, you know. That's one thing that you do when you're guiding is you're watching things the client can't see out of the corner of their eye, maybe for a fish over here, because they're myopic on, you know, almost everybody, and myself included, gets myopic about, say, a particular fish or your drift or anything. But when you fish a really long time, you start to have a more, I don't know, a background vision where you're seeing what's going on. You're kind of making a plan in another part of your brain. You know, somewhere I got in here, the fisherman's brain isn't very big, but apparently, you know, to do what we do. But, you know, you do it a long time, and you start making a plan as you're fishing the one spot, you know. But that takes a lot of fishing, years and years and decades of fishing to get to that place. That would be instinctive fishing, I guess, huh?
Yeah, I mean, I think I hear this from most of my guests that are guides, and they say, you know, one of the biggest mistakes or omissions that they see from most fly fishers is they don't observe enough. And like you said, taking it all in on the river as you're down there and being open to what you may see, smell, hear, that kind of thing. And then, but yet that's what a guide is doing all the time, right, is observing.
Right.
And
yeah.
Also, don't you have an advantage of having been down that stretch of water before and knowing that, hey, you know, last week we pulled a 21-inch rainbow out from behind that rock, and that ought to be a good spot this week, too.
Well, that tells you two things. That 21-inch rainbow is going to be harder to catch. And also that, yeah, it is a good spot. But, you know, one of the things about guiding is that you really – we keep incredible scrutiny on how much a piece of water gets fished here in northern, because the fishing pressure is such a huge issue. So that, you know, when you talk about that 21-inch rainbow being caught, you know, a fish that old and that big is going to wise up real quick. And so, you know, that's another huge, I spent so much time in instinctive on the fishing pressure because it's just an immense part of the equation. And what happens really is the average fisherman doesn't know that, doesn't see that, and doesn't have the overall, you know, we're in the fishing business, so I've got a half a dozen guides gone out a day, and then we all confer, and we know what's been fished, you know, and one of the first questions I'll ask a guide is, well, what's the footprints look like? How many people have been in a particular stretch? Because here in northern New Mexico, fishing's pretty light, you know. We can generally find places that haven't been fished. And when a place hasn't been fished, I know I'm...
No, this is a great sidebar. Keep going.
Yeah, it's a sidebar. That's right. But, yeah, it's just a huge factor for us, you know. And so if we can find... It's so interesting because we have discovered over the years that, you know, we have all these theories about, oh, the trout are going to take, you know, just the fly just a certain way at this time of day, or they won't be feeding, or they're going to be all persnickety and this and that. And when we find a stretch of water that hasn't been fished that season yet, all of those things are out the door, and the fish will eat just about anything that comes by. So it really gives an idea of, and that's the case, and we get to do that here on the Rio Grande because it's in a big, nasty canyon. And so there are stretches of it that don't get fished for, you know, weeks or months at a time.
So are there some tips you could give about, you know, let's say we're working a stretch or floating a stretch, and it's an area that's guided. And I know in some cases, like, well, down in New Mexico, San Juan River, you go to Texas Hole to put your boat in, and it's like 8:30, and there's, you know, 10 guides lined up to put their boats in all at the same time.
Right.
Yeah, so does it pay sometimes to leave later to get out there earlier, or can you ever beat the guides, or is there?
Well, it pays to hire the guide, but there at the San Juan, so much of the fishing is right there at the Texas Hole and down, and because it's all floated. But just as a tip for anybody, this is kind of a localized thing, but there's been a bunch of work done for those people listening that fish at San Juan. There's been a bunch of work done on the water above the Texas Hole, where holes have been blasted into the rock and new holding water has been created above the Texas Hole. But that also goes with the point I'm trying to make that, you know, most of the guides don't go up from there. Fish numbers are usually not quite as good up above Texas Hole, so it's not fished as much. But now, it's just in this last year that these projects have been completed, and so there's a bunch of new water up there. I haven't fished it yet. I just wrote an article on this for New Mexico Magazine, but I haven't got to fish it myself.
Well, I know another thing is, you know, we experienced that. We were down there fishing. We had our own boat, and we weren't using a guide. We'd fished the San Juan before. So we were down there and with everybody else putting our boat in that day, and we started catching fish right away and had a good day. And so the next day we said, hey, you know, let's get there about an hour earlier before all the guides do. Get in there first, and maybe we'll do better. So we did. Uh-huh. We went fishless for that first hour.
Well, the
until the guides came, and then all the fish started biting. And
yeah, that'll tell you something. Well, the San Juan is, you know, I have an instinctive, there's also a lot of attention paid to conditions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if the water's too cold or too warm, you know, it sets the pace. And the San Juan is the most glaring example of that there is, because the fish feed, you know, between, I'm throwing this out because I really, I'm not an expert on it anymore. I used to be, you know, wonderful hours, like from 11 to 4 or 5. And, you know, as the weather gets hotter, that'll be, and this is true in general of almost all trout streams. And people have a way tendency to in normal weather, in say 70 degrees, you know, which is ideal kind of weather in the 70s, something like that. Fish feed midday, and people often trash the water they're going to fish early in the morning and then quit when it's time to start.
Yeah.
And really, and I have done a lot of, we take people fishing in Argentina too, and I fish there a lot, and it's the same thing there. 1 o'clock in the afternoon is about as good as it gets in general. Of course, there's evening fishing, and that's always an important component, especially where there's a lot of hatches, and it's important in the east, you know.
Yeah.
But 1 o'clock in the afternoon is, you know, usually about the best time of day. And, there's these live sales at first light.
Yeah, I interviewed Bill Edrington on the Arkansas River, which I'm sure.
Yeah, Bill knows his stuff, yep.
Yeah, and he said, this is where, you know, we figured this all out down on the San Juan, that the water was just too cold and the guys knew when to start. But Bill said something similar on the Arkansas. He says, you know, people drive all the way from Denver to get over here at the crack of dawn. And he says, I tell them, forget, drive over, but go have a nice long breakfast, 3 cups of coffee, and then kind of just, you know, nonchalantly wander out to the river about 10:30 or 11 and get started.
Yeah.
And then he says, but stay late. Stay till after dark, because that's when you're going to get your big fish.
Right, especially there on the Arkansas where it's brown trout. And they really do feed. In Argentina, I mean, almost all the big browns we catch are in way, way late in the day, or, you know, after the sun's going down. And that's true in a lot of heavily fished places as well.
Yeah. I need to take a quick break here, Taylor. We had fun talking there. But I'll be right back, and we'll continue our conversation.
Great.
Keeney's Fly Shop in Sacramento, California features classes on all aspects of fly fishing. They have an extensive inventory and fly tying department and a friendly, experienced staff whose primary goal is your complete satisfaction. Among their many services, one can book private waters or take advantage of their international travel service. Visit their extensive website at www.keeney.com. That's K-I-E-N-E.com. Or call Keeney's Fly Shop at 1-800-400-0359. That's 1-800-400-0359. 0359. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Taylor Streit about instinctive fly fishing. If you'd like to ask Taylor a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, Taylor, I usually ask my guests at this time of the show is, you know, what's going on in your fly fishing world. So tell us a bit about your business down there and what other things you got going on.
Well, I've been guiding since Moby Dick was a minnow, I think I wrote someplace. But I started Tao's Fly Shop in 1980, and my son now owns the shop. And it's quite the thriving enterprise, and I have the guiding end of the business. We're both under the same web page, which is talisflyshop.com. And we don't fish the San Juan. That's too far away for us, really. But we do fish the Taos area, Angel Fire, which includes the Cimarron, and we fish a little up into Colorado on the Conejos. We fish some private water there. And then we guide quite a bit out of Chama, New Mexico also. So we cover a lot of territory, the main draw being here the Rio Grande.
Yeah.
And we do I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
And we do, you know, I have my son does schools, and I do schools, and they're on my webpage. I haven't put in the new dates for this year coming up, but I just got asked the question about the schools, and I do three different schools, instinctive fly fishing school for kind of experienced fishermen, and a beginner's school, and a guide school. And the guide school has been how can I say? It's quite popular, and I just had lunch with a fellow about that yesterday.
Yeah, there was a question by Silas Gray in Missouri. He asked you, he said, your second edition of Instinctive Fly Fishing is awesome. Succinct, fluff-free chapters really stuck with me, so quite the compliment there.
Okay.
And he says, your instinctive class is now calling me to Taos. So he says, since a lot of the book has to do with common sense fishing and guiding, could you contrast your guide and instinctive classes? And I guess he wants to know which one should he come to, or what would make the
right teaching
factor.
That was the lunch I had yesterday with a fella. And really, and that's what I was explaining, and I often explain it. The guide school, you know, guiding is, I mean, there's, you know, we spend 15 minutes on the proper way to spread mustard, you know. There's a lot of psychology to guiding. There's a lot of just work things, you know. People, the first thing I kind of say in the guide school is, you know, if you think somebody's going to pay you a couple hundred dollars a day to fish, you know, this is not the place. That's not what happens, you know. You get to fish for demonstration, you know, but nobody, unfortunately, but I get that sometimes on the street here where I live. People, oh, you're the guy that gets paid to fish. Well, not quite. We get paid to really instruct. And, you know, your goal is to have people catch fish, and the ends to that goal are usually to teach people to improve their fishing. Sometimes the poor conditions you have to fish, the client often gets their money's worth more so because you spend the day on instruction. And, you know, and all my guides are really versed on that. And that's really the strength of our business because we mostly fish on public water. And I just have guides that do such a good job that people come back and they want Brian or they want Christoph or
So back to the difference between the classes, are you saying that the guide class is more about how to instruct and teach and spend quality time with our clients than actually how to fish, which is what your instinctive is about?
Right. Exactly.
Okay.
And the instinctive class is more about how you personally improve your fishing.
Right.
It's a whole different thing with a client, because the first one of the first misconceptions a guide has, you take a very good fisherman and you turn him into a guide, and first thing is the heartbreak of realizing that you don't have the rod in your hand. And so,
the other guy's screwing everything up. Right?
Exactly. So that fish rising out in the middle of the river, well, you can just try and divert your client's eyes from that fish so they don't get brokenhearted when you know that they can't catch it.
Yeah. Okay, well, good. And I just want to make note about that you did publish the second edition of Instinctive Fly Fishing, and it's had quite a few revisions, and everybody seems to like it a lot. So, did you want to say anything about that before we...
Yeah, it's in the second printing already. The original Instinctive Fly Fishing, when I was a kid, I fished with Nick Lyon some in New York, and I grew up fishing the Catskill streams, the Beaverkill and the Ausable and places like that. So I knew some of the fly fishing hoi polloi back from those days. Before Nick retired from the publishing business, he personally, and he helped me out with the title. I was going to go with Intuitive, and he said, no, Instinctive's the way to go. But at any rate, the hardcover came out in 2002 and sold well, and so they approached me about doing this version. And I really have a lot of things lacking in the original one. In this one, I have a travel chapter. I have a lot on insects. Here I'm looking at it now, drift boat fishing. I didn't have anything about that in the original. And I completely rewrote the whole book. You know, I made a lot of work out of it. I rewrote the whole thing, and I have chapters in here: hiring a guide, fishing eddies, reading waters, big, and it's everything that I learned about fly fishing from a guide's point of view.
Right.
And
right.
One other thing I should say is that when I originally sat down to do this book, I did what a writer does, and I started writing and theorizing and pontificating and went, wow, this isn't anything to offer here. And then what I did was I took a tape recorder and I put it in my vest. And so when I was guiding, I kept notes of what was actually happening and why people caught fish and why they didn't. And so I got into a lot of places that you never notice. And you never notice when you're fishing yourself, like somebody's golf swing. You know, somebody will stand back or video it. And it's the same thing with a cast, really. And you stand back from somebody, and after a while, you can start to figure out ways to improve their cast. And that at the proper time, that's the secret of guiding, is doing that at the proper time with the person that is ready to listen.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about some of the other things. Let's talk about flies for a few minutes. What's your decision-making process when you decide to put what's in your boxes and so forth? I kind of get the feeling that you might not have 10 boxes in your vest, or do you?
Well, I probably do through sloth. I should throw half of them out, I think, because they're used flies. But I fish with the same setup, a guide with the same setup, an awful lot, which is about a great big dry fly that's not going to sink, a royal stimulator very often, and a small kind of a 16 nymph with a wide gap hook and a heavy bead, a tungsten bead. I mean, that's who knows. If the water's not that deep, then I won't go so heavy a fly. But, you know, just a dry dropper setup. But a lot of times, you know, we're in a situation now where we have one place is fishing really well, so it's been fished a little hard. So we are going down. One of my guides has been fishing. Ron has been fishing with real small stuff and fooling a lot of fish with that. And that's what happens when you get fishing pressure. You need to get small and light tippets. But my style is usually to try and walk more and get in the fish that haven't been pestered so much. So fly selection Yeah. One of the interesting things, I know I have this in the book someplace, in the fly thing, is that I fish with guys all the time that will take out a fly box, a really serious fisher, overly serious fisherman and they'll have a box of, well, we want a size about a 16 bead head. And they'll take out a box with 300 size 16 bead heads. And then maybe an hour later, we want a size 18. Well, I left the box of size 18 bead heads in the car. And they've got so many boxes that are so incredibly organized and, how can I say, individualized that they may not, oh, I didn't bring my streamer box or this or that. So, you know, I'm kind of a slob, and I got a box just filled with all the junky flies. But that means I can always find the odd one I need. You know, if I need a woolly booger or this or that, it's in there somewhere,
yeah.
You know. But it's kind of a common, I think that's the analytical fisherman that I was talking about.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to remember who it was. Now I'm the name, one of our guests who did some underwater photography. And, mm-hmm. You know, after interviewing him, it kind of changed my whole philosophy about, you know, matching flies exactly and so forth. Because he was basically saying, I think it might have been, well, I don't want to say. He was basically saying, hey, when you're down there and you're watching these fish, they're taking in about anything and everything, sticks, rocks, everything that's coming down the river. And they're taking it in, spitting it out as fast as they can, and just keeping the good stuff, you know. And his point was, you know, if you get anything down in their feeding lane, they're probably going to taste it. And if you're quick enough to get the hook set, then you're going to get the fish. But he put a lot more emphasis on getting the fly, whatever fly, in the right place was more important to him than
right.
the actual, whether it's a 16 or an 18.
And the drift.
And
the drift. I mean, the drift has
yep.
got to be impeccable, and that's huge. And now when you're in a situation where there's a hatch and fish are feeding and they're not taking what you're giving them, then it's time to start changing flies.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you really add up an average day of trout fishing, that's, you know, not that much of the day. That's maybe 20% of the day, perhaps. And the rest of it is you're just looking for the occasional fish that might be feeding. And so what you want is to use the biggest, like with a nymph, you want to use the biggest thing you can so that if you hook a fish, so that they'll see it from a distance, for one thing, and so that the larger hook will land the fish better than a smaller hook.
Right.
And so, you know, you try and go with something big and visible if they take it. But if fish are feeding and you can't, then you got to start, I think I call it head scratching in the book.
Yeah.
And picking through the little flies and getting the right one.
By the way, folks, it was Ralph Cutters who I was trying to think of. And we did a show called Fish Food. So if you want to go to the archive and listen to that, you can hear what I was talking about. Well, we did get a question in, Taylor, about from Phil in British Columbia. And he wanted to know about crane flies. And I don't know if you know about crane flies or not, but since he asked the question on your show, I'm throwing it out there. He says, are these aquatic insects, and do they have a place in the fly box? If they do, are they strictly a dry fly pattern, or is there a nymph as well? Are there popular commercial patterns?
Well, that's a great question for me, because my best-known fly and that I'm quite proud of, I guess, yeah, is called the Poundmeister. And it is crane fly larva, I thought, sounded a little dry, so I went with Poundmeister. And what it is a big, meaty crane fly larva imitation. Now, those things, it is an aquatic insect, and it's just a worm, and it's like a grub, really. And it almost has kind of a neutral buoyancy to it. In our water here, it's an extremely important insect because it tends to be more common in low elevation siltated waters and the lower portions of the Rio Grande here and some other streams around here, the Culebra north of here and Well, just a bit, but the little bit larger, lower elevation streams seem to have a real preponderance of crane flies. And the adults, so my Poundmeister nymph has a bead, and it's probably online. It can be found online. I know there's a tying instructions for it. But what I did with it, and it really took me a long time to really get it the way I wanted it, and what I did was I ribbed it with blue dun hackle. And if you made the exact imitation, you know, it just looks like a worm, like a grub. So, but it really started to work when I put the hackle on it, because I kind of feel that, you know, this is a theory, I guess, is that the hackle suspends it in the water kind of like the natural nymph, so that it drifts through the water a little more naturally. Now, the adult of the crane fly is a big, long-legged, brown critter that is not all that available to the trout, I don't think. We do at times use them, but it's not a hatch like, you know, mayflies or something where you see a whole lot of them. But there are times in the summer when they are around, and a grasshopper with really long legs is usually a pretty good imitation of it, something with rubber legs sticking out of it or something like that. But it's a dark brownish insect, big thing, about inch and a half long. And the nymph can actually be quite big, but I don't tie it in any bigger than a regular sang size 6 or so, because once you start getting real big, you want that thing to sink, or we do here. Rio Grande is a rather deep river, and usually when we're fishing it, we're trying to get deep. And if you've got a big fly, just the size of the fly, the bulk of it keeps it from going down very fast. So we tie that thing not all that big, but big enough on a 6 or an 8 hook, 2, 4, 8, 7 Temco hook, I think it is, so that you hook a fish with it, and it's in big trouble, because it's really a solid hook with a wide gap. And yeah, really holds the fish well.
Okay, good, good. Let's take a quick break here, and then we'll come back and talk about reading water. I know you said that was a big thing you'd like to talk about, so let's do that. Women's fly fishing in Alaska is owned and operated by well-known female guide Pudge Kleinkopf. Women's fly fishing offers several lodge-based fly fishing schools for women, as well as an array of small group-guided trips for women and couples to some of Alaska's best-known waters for salmon, rainbow trout, Arctic grayling, and char. Pudge also leads saltwater fly fishing groups to Mexico each spring. Beginners are welcome and equipment is provided. Learn more about fly fishing for women at www.womensflyfishing.net. That's womensflyfishing.net. Or call Pudge at 907-274-7113. That's 907-274-7113. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Taylor Streit about instinctive fly fishing. If you'd like to ask Taylor a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Let me look at a couple of these, Taylor, that I have online here. You're not seeing these, but let me see. We're going to talk about some of these later on.
Is there a reading water question? You had mentioned that.
Yeah, I'm going to get to that in just a second.
Okay.
Well, this is a localized question. I'll get this one out of the way.
Uh-huh.
Danny in Tahoe City, California, says he grew up in northern New Mexico. Since moving away, took up fly fishing. He says he usually comes home each August. He says, how does the box fish that time of year?
I know what he's saying.
Okay. And he said, would the Rio Chama above be better in summer? So what's the box?
Yeah. The box is an area of the Rio Grande. Precisely. He may be talking in a more general term, but precisely what the box is about a 10-mile section of the Rio Grande straight west of Taos that is so vertical that I hate to admit it, there's a whole lot of it that I've never fished. And I'm supposed to be the expert. I have the Fly Fishing to Mexico book, which has been on sale for 12 years and sold 20,000 copies, and, you know, and I've written all about it. And there's a whole lot of it I haven't fished because I'm not man enough. But it is a rugged territory, And it's got, you know, it's got rattlesnakes and bighorn sheep. And it's, but to answer the question, what he's talking about is the Rio Grande. In the Rio Grande, you know, streams go through cycles. And the Rio Grande right now, and a lot of it here, and with the climate changes that we got going on, a big factor is siltation. And here in the Southwest, about anywhere really, but especially in the Southwest, siltation is a huge factor. So you have a really bad rain event, and it washes a bunch of silt in there, and it smothers the bottom, and really the stream suffers. The insects suffer, and then the fish, you know, correspondingly. And the Rio Grande hasn't had that happen in a number of years, and so it's really prospering. And with the drought conditions, it's a spring river, so it's doing exceptionally well. We had a great summer in there, but it promises to be even better next year. Because it is a spring creek, and so the lower it is, the more influence the spring's water has, and spring water, as most fishermen know, is very rich. The Chama he asked about has several different sections, and I have two chapters in my book on the Chama River, and I've spent many, many years guiding there. The Chama's suffering from low water. And there's some irrigation conflicts, and I've been involved with that. It kind of fits into an environmental world that I spend a lot of time in. And but the Chama has two tailwaters. It's the other major river that feeds the Rio Grande in northern New Mexico, and it's actually 40% of the total makeup of the Rio Grande drainage. And the Chama has its problems because of the upper parts, because of the drought. Where it goes below two lakes, Abiquiu Lake and El Vado Lake, it's running quite high right now, but it is a winter fishery. And so it's an appropriate thing to talk about, because we do fish it in the winter. And
so in answer to his question, he said in August, sounds like maybe the Rio Grande would be a better place to be spending your time.
Yeah, the August, the Rio Grande fished very well last year, and we were quite amazed, because usually that's too hot in there.
Tough month.
Yeah, August is a tough fishing month anywhere, exactly.
Right. Yeah.
But it actually fished very well last year, and a lot of it is because of the extremely low conditions. The spring water has more of an influence, and so that the water temperature stays down, it's just really thriving right now. So, whereas the Chama, the tailwaters on the Chama are not good in summer. And but the upper Chama, actually in Colorado, where it comes out of the mountains in Colorado, is a good place to fish in August.
Okay. So. Well, let's get talking about reading water. Harold in Forest, Virginia, wrote in. He says, what is your strategy when you go to a new piece of water? Observation? So, obviously, that's not a – of course, you know, a piece of water that you're familiar with can change from year to year, so sometimes they look like new pieces to you, I bet.
Right. You know, that's that's the way you approach that is the way I would too, because a common mistake that fishermen make, that guides don't make, not a good one, is that when a water level changes on a river, you gotta, the fish move. And so you've got to adjust accordingly. One thing I have, I think it's in the Reading Water chapter, is that canyon rivers, like the Rio Grande, for instance, really fish best when the water's low, because then you kind of can get at the fish, and they're doing well. Where, obviously, if you have a wide, shallow stream, the Chama, for instance, is a wider, shallower stream. it's not doing too good when the water is low. So, you know, there's an awful lot of things in play there. I would like to read something on that Reading Water. This is the introduction to the Reading Water chapter, and it says, one reason why anglers do better with a guide than they do on their own is because a guide has them fish only high percentage spots. The average unguided angler pounds all the water. The guide, however, has learned from experience which places actually produce. Sure, other spots may hold trout, but that doesn't mean they're going to yield them. The currents may be too confusing, the depths too great, or perhaps the setup is such that the fish always see you coming. One thing all hunting holes have in common is they fish well. By that I mean these spots are situated so that the perfect approach and drift can be achieved. So you get my point there. You know, it's like when you're guiding and you fish the stretch for years and years and years and years and years, you know, you might see some fish, but you don't waste your time on them. You know, and you might have a client just drooling and tugging on your shirt sleeve to, but no, you can't catch that fish, or you know, we can't fish that spot or fish it from here. One thing we do when we're guiding very much is have often more experienced fishermen shorten up their fishing and not try and fish the far side of the river and get in impossible situations where your fly is going to drag. If it's going to drag, then, you know, just shouldn't be bothering the fish.
I remember, in fact, it was on the San Juan, there was a spot that we discovered where it's just what you just described, this honey hole kind of thing, where you just put your fly in and the water just took it down to where all these fish were. And I swear, every other cast we were getting hookups for, you know, an hour on end. And I knew it had to be the way that water was bringing the food right into those fish. And yet there's other times when I can see fish and I can't get that fly near that fish's nose for anything because of the currents and the, you know, the drift and so forth. It just becomes almost impossible. So I really hear what you're saying and understand it, you know, from experience of some are just not worth the effort, you know, it seems like.
And guiding's a numbers game, you know.
Right.
We're looking for. A lot of times, that's not what somebody wants, you know. A lot of times, you want the challenge. You know, I really address that in this edition of the book. Whereas the first book, I kind of said, well, you know, yeah, don't bother to fish for that fish. And then in this edition, I have a chapter on fishing for difficult fish, like. Yeah, a lot of us actually enjoy that, you know.
I suppose you have to tell your guide that at the beginning of the day, saying, "Hey, you know, I'd like to catch 20-plus inch fish today, and I don't care if I only catch one, but my goal is. I don't want to catch 20 12-inchers. I want to at least the guide is set up for, and the fisherman has the expectation, you know, that they might come back empty-handed, you know. But So what areas of the river are the most productive for the most part when you're out there? Where does a guide take you to get the most productive?
Well, that's a great question. No, not really.
Okay.
A riffle leading into deeper water is almost always awful good stuff because then you've got everything in one package. If you have a nice, even riffle that's not broken, you can probably get a good drift into it. And if there's a pool below it, the fish from the pool will move up into the riffle when they feed. And so that, you know, when you get into more broken water, that's when you have to have more expertise. They have to get close to get a good drift or do some fancy tricks of mending or this or that, and usually as soon as you start getting in the tricks, your fish numbers go down. So you know, if you have a nice straightforward situation where, say, you're a right-hander and you're fishing on the bank that puts your rod over the you know, the right side. I was just talking. I'm doing the Texas, what's it called, Trout Fest with Lefty Cray and Wanda Taylor in mid-February in New Braunfels, Texas. And I was talking with Wanda about how, you know, my demonstrations that I do are not really casting ones per se, but they're more fishing. You know, how do you hold a rod to fish this particular, you know, like fishing a normal drift, kind of pointing the rod at the fly and following it down and then lifting it, say, at the end of the drift. Or it's easier to show than explain. But yeah, so I would say the ripple water is usually what we're looking for. You know, I mean, all rivers are different. That's around here, but most rivers that I know of, that's what we're usually looking for. The more shallow riffle water there is, the more insects there's going to be, because that's where mm-hmm. the insects, especially mayflies, really really thrive.
Okay. Talk about rigging here for a minute. Silas Gray wrote in, and he wanted to know what you do to keep fly lines clean during the day for you and your client. Do you bother with that? Is that something you're concerned with?
I do absolutely nothing. I haven't cleaned a fly line since I was a kid. But that may be more my not to say that it shouldn't be done, perhaps, but these new fly lines, I think, are pretty they're pretty amazing. I know my son has a huge selection here at the shop, and there's you know, super floating tips and they all are closed celled at the end now, so that they don't sink at the end, and we really don't have the coating on them is so superb now mm-hmm. that dressing is really pretty much a thing of the past.
Oh, okay. I just noticed we got in a question here on the internet, Mac Baldwin in Farmington, New Mexico. Uh-huh. And this kind of goes back to finding fish and, you know, reading the waters and so forth. But he says, I fished the Animas River in Durango, Colorado. There was great fishing, but all the fish were small stocked fish. Where would I look for larger fish in a freestone river like this?
Probably farther away from Durango.
I think those are all stock fish up there.
I think that from my experience, I know where he's talking about. And Durango's a big town. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you're in the fishing business, like when I started fishing in South America, one of the first things I looked at, and I was kind of and they're somewhat in groundbreaking 20 years ago when there wasn't that many people fishing in Argentina. And, you know, you could fly over an area, and if there was a lot of houses and people down there, well, the fishing's just probably not going to be that good. And I think they're probably on the Animas. I know one of my guys was just fishing over by there this weekend, and they hooked a big fish or two, and I'm sure they're there. But when you got a lot of people around like that, those big fish, they get caught one time maybe in the spring, and then they're either going to go to nocturnal feeding or just being real careful because they've been through this drill before. So that's, you know, then you're catching the small fish. So really a big one huge advantage to do with that kind of situation in a heavily fished place is really be on top of the conditions and fish it way early in the year. Those big fish are much more active first thing. And, you know, when water temperatures are still cold, and the biggest fish that we catch very often in the whole season are way early in the season, just as the water's coming down from runoff, because that's when they're off on the sides getting out of the main flow, and they're stupid and hungry. So
yeah. Okay, good advice. Question in from Bill Gates in Sterling, Alaska. How do you determine where you place strike indicators in split shot, and when would you use them, or should you use them? Is that something you use with your clients, their strike indicators?
Yeah. Oh, I love that question, yeah. When we don't have, you know, I usually use a dry dropper, but there's a lot of times we know they're not going to take the dry fly. When it's cold or the water's quite deep, and then we'll use the strike indicator. And we really like the cloth strike indicators because they, what's the word, telegraph what's going on down below a lot better than some of the other indicators. Though like a cork kind of one is a good one to mend to. You can mend around and keep from jostling. I even have a thing in Instinctive that shows a rig where you use braided Dacron and for deep water fishing. But and as far as the weight goes, you know what I do anymore is I really try and get the weight out of the fly rather than using weight. In other words, when I tie nymphs, I use widest gap hook I can, and I'll make them with different size beads, and so that if I run into a deeper stretch, instead of putting weight on, I might add a little tippet, and maybe the same fly if it's working, but with a bigger bead. And so I try and get the job done with the fly. Sometimes I'll add another nymph, a foot or so down, you know, if I'm running one nymph down and put another one to get a little deeper down. So, I kind of got out of using weight some time back, and you know it mars up your leader, it hits you in the head, it's just kind of messy. So if you can get the job done with the fly with a heavier bead, it can be helpful.
That's the way to go. Yeah. We had a question here come in on the internet relating to that as well. Jim Kilburn in Westcliff, he asks, is indicator fishing the best way to develop instinctive skills, or is it better to develop skills watching the fly line and leader?
That's a great question. It's better to watch the fly line, no doubt, if you want to. But it's stressful to do that all day. You know, that's the way I grew up fishing. I mean, talk about fishermen having little brains. I mean, that we couldn't figure out to use a bobber 50 years ago when we were fishing, and that really just came about in the last 25 years, I don't know, is kind of crazy because it's pretty simple. But really what it is, it's a whole lot less work. You can watch the fly line. And I have this in Instinctive because I've seen my brother do it. I've seen my son Nick do it. My brother Jackson Stride is a fly shop in Breckenridge, Colorado, mountain angler. I should give him a plug while we're at it here. But he's just a master fisherman, and he can just raise up the rod in a lot of cases and just take up the slack and watch the end of the line and set the hook. And but that's a lot of concentration. I mean, I'm getting to be almost I go bait fishing sometimes with a great big red and white bobber, so that'll tell you how lazy I am. But it's a lot of work when you just don't have that bobber on there.
So it takes more attention, more focus.
Yeah,
Which but isn't
certainly
necessarily
works well. And there's definitely times when fish in on a bright day. They don't want that strike indicator slapping down over their head. Mm-hmm. So there's certainly circumstances when, or when you can see a fish that's down a ways and you need to give it a nymph. If you can do it without the strike indicator and you just watch the fish and look for it to open its mouth, you've got it's less likely that you'd spook that fish because that strike indicator will spook quite a few fish.
Got some a bunch of questions here on kind of strategy and tactics specific situations. Phil up in British Columbia asks, he says, when fishing off a shoal or sunken island and into a deeper drop-off, is there a maximum depth beyond which you should stop, he says, migrating out and begin to work your way back to shore and back to the shoal? For instance, once you hit, say, 20 feet, is that far enough out into the drop-off area? Can it be said that trout deeper than 20 feet or whatever the magic number is are probably not feeding at the moment? Sounds like he's trying to say how deep do you need to go?
Yeah, I think he's got his own answer there. I know for me personally, taste-wise, I don't like fishing deep with sinking lines and an inch and a fly along and such. And I'd rather I have a chapter on lake fishing, and really what I'm all about the shallow water fishing and looking for the fish inshore and maybe getting the position up on the bank a ways so you can see down. There's some situations I know, like in Argentina with brook trout, you can often find places where they're eating, where they just stay very deep because they're feeding on snails, and that's how you got to catch them. I mean, they don't come into the shallows really. Personally, I just find it so much more interesting to just try and stick with the shallow water. And from the places I fish, that's where the fish are going to do most of their feeding. Though I know people catch them a lot deeper.
We've done several shows on lake fishing, which our listeners can go look in our archives. Denny Rickards he talks about deep is not always better. I know when I was a kid, I always thought, oh, the really huge are on the bottom of the deepest part of the lake, and that's where I got to fish. You know,
the Loch Ness Monster is down there holding on the bottom. Yeah.
But that's not true. And, you know, they're where oxygen and where life is that they can eat, and that's really where you want to find. And that may not be the deepest part of the lake or the stream. So we got another question. Steve Goodchild in the U.K. Writes in, he says, I'm pretty much a wet fly fisherman using mainly traditional river flies, spiders, winged olives, nymphs, etc., sizes from 16 to 12 for trout. He says, whenever you start fishing, if you your chosen stretch of river, you always seem to catch smaller trout before you catch the larger trout. Is this because small fish will have a go at any fly and not be spooked? And the reason he's asking is, should you keep the same fly on the line that is catching the small fish because it worked okay for them to work your way up to the large fish? Does he have a strategy there?
You've got smart listeners, I must say. These are really good questions. And that's a great question for professional guide, because when you're a professional guide, you get to spend so much time on the water, and, you know, this is how you make your living. So you pay attention to what the truth is about this. And my take in on this is that almost always – the little fish are going to eat before the big fish. And so when we get out for a day's fishing, say we arrive at 10 o'clock in the morning, if we're on time, we catch nothing to start. And then we catch some, and of course, you know, it's fishing. This is a general thing. But and then we start catching some small fish. And, you know, then I kind of breathe a sigh of relief because I know that the action hasn't started for the day. And then the fish generally get bigger. To that, you know, maybe 1 o'clock in the afternoon magic time. And then usually the fishing is horrible late afternoon about any kind of trout fishing. And then, you know, it's good again in late in the evening. But, that's my take. Wasn't there another part to that question too about using the same fly?
Right.
I don't know. I really don't know the answer to that. Certainly, it would be the starting place. But so often when you see this circumstance, when you see just my book's available in the UK, by the way, and I got a great radio interview on BBC Radio. When you see this coincides almost always in our observation guiding with insect activity. So when you start seeing the small fish feeding, and you know, just a smattering of them, this and that, well, usually there's a smattering of insects too, just a smattering, and then that increases, and then you know it takes the peak of the insect activity or hatch to get the bigger ones eaten.
Well, like you said before, when you're fishing a riffle into a pool, there's a hierarchy down below there, isn't there, of the larger fish and the smaller fish.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
So how does that relate to what we're talking? Let's say there's a hatch on, like you said. You know, you got some insect activity. You're fishing
right.
a riffle into a pool, and there is a hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
How does that work with small versus large and what you're catching first?
Well, yeah, that's interesting because you can easily get fooled by that. And I'm sure that a lot of listeners have been fooled by that. Whereas you get up into what's the really shallow water, you know, usually the right way to fish a riffle in that circumstance is when the fish are in there feeding, which is a whole lot of our trout fishing, is you start down at the bottom and you fish your way up. And if they're really active, usually the biggest fish will be up, way up in the shallowest water and really surprise you, or you can spook them in there. And that's just such an easy thing to do, is spook big fish that are feeding in shallow water that just surprise you, because they're getting up to the head of the chow line in that deal. Now, that's certainly not always the case, and that depends on the character of the riffle, but awful lot of times the biggest fish is way up there in the shallow, and you're just really surprised. I know happens certainly on the San Juan when they're feeding on mayflies like Pale Morning Duns.
Are you? We did get a question on the internet about San Juan worms. Are those things you use on the Rio Grande too, or?
We use San Juan worm around here a lot. We use the San Juan worm everywhere. We use it in Argentina. We use it here on the Rio Grande. We use it in a lot of creeks. But we don't use it. The San Juan worm was actually, I knew the guys that Jim Aubrey, he's deceased, and Bob Pels originated that fly. And it's to imitate an aquatic worm. But we use it around here. I think we are imitating a regular old earthworm, because when we use it is when earthworms would be in the water, because I was a bait fisherman before I was a fly fisherman, and I remember that, you know, when the water's dirty and it's up, or it's rained, or it's the end of runoff, or runoff itself, you're fishing with a worm. Or the, you know, worm imitation. So we're fishing it for an earthworm, and yeah, so we fish it a lot. Yeah, we fish a lot when you know springtime.
That's
especially.
What Anthony from Half Moon Bay, California. That's what he was asking: is how would you use them? So what you're saying is use them differently. If you're over on the San Juan River in a nice clear stream, then you're really simulating the aquatic worm.
Yeah.
Maybe over on the Rio Grande, you're doing something totally different. Okay.
Yeah. I think you're you know, like we have a lake here that we fish that has some big rainbows in it. It's called Eagle Nest Lake, and there's times when in the spring when that lake is coming up, it's an impoundment, and so the water rises in the spring. And so that some of the and it's grassy banked, so that the water's coming up, right? And You can just go along and see the earthworms, what was earth, and now it gets flooded. And you can see the earthworms crawling around in there. And you can find these great big trout out, and that's when that thing also works great. And will, like, hang it off of an indicator or a dry fly or something like that.
Okay.
Or even fish it on kind of a slow strip.
Okay. Gary in Williamstown, Massachusetts, asks, as a very heavy flood, he said, and he has got very in capital letters, a very heavy flood, as they've experienced out there recently. As it recedes, where do you look for trout and how do you fish them? And is there any difference between, say, browns and rainbows?
Argentina, I think, is after Sandy or something like that. Absolutely. Now, very, very heavy, I don't know. I mean, you get, maybe there's a trout swimming in your bedroom or something, but
let's
I
just
know
say
that,
the water's all dirtied up in a, like a runoff situation.
Right. Well, I mean, I can only speak for, probably not very, very, very heavy, but, a big water in the springtime. And really what big high water does is it concentrates fish. I mean, they're going to go where they can get out of that current and eddies on the side and slow places can have a bunch of trout stacked up one after another in there. They're not going to be out holding in that heavy current sitting on the bottom or anything like that. You may just have to walk a whole bunch to find the slower places on the side, where they can get out of that big flow. And then you can find often many fish, and that's where your San Juan worm comes in, that's for sure. And
I
my pastor fly is a good choice there, too. In fact, we'll fish a lot with an indicator with a San Juan worm and the poundmeister together.
Mm. Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Yeah,
I've never tried that combination.
Well, it's a mess to cast because it's two great big flies with an indicator, but
yeah.
You
did dedicate a chapter in your book to eddy fishing. So I wanted to, and since you just brought that up with a high runoff situation, how do you fish the eddies? That's always been a kind of a dilemma for me because you've got that water that's not moving there, but you know there's fish sitting in there. So.
Yeah, no, in fact, yeah. Eddies, let's see if I can find that, because I know I can't say it any better than I wrote it. But eddies are, it's on page 144, and what it says is, excuse me just a second, is that big trout do very well in eddies. It's an easy life. No fast water to battle, food constantly circulating, and a blanket of foam providing overhead security. More importantly, trout are seldom removed from eddies because few fly fishermen know how to fish these great spots. Most anglers mindlessly throw straight casts into the eddies from too far away, and the fly and line drag across the revolving currents and alarm the fish. And then I've got illustrations in here, and my book has these wonderful illustrations by Pete Chadwell, who probably a lot of people know because he does illustrations all over the fly fishing publishing business, and showing about getting really close to an eddy. So you're fishing straight down almost, unless it's in a monstrous river and you can't do that. But in a normal sized trout stream where you can get to an eddy and say you've got a grassy bank and that water's kind of slow, a lot of times what we'll do is we'll drop the fly straight down, lower the rod slowly, and then walk the fly around the eddy so that it's just going straight down because you can't get adrift from any kind of distance away from it, though people try all the time. But if you just drop the fly straight down and then kind of walk it around so that with the rod tip straight up above the thing, and then when a fish takes, you'll feel it, So And it sounds good in theory, but it's not perhaps so easy to do. But in the right place, that's a deadly, deadly setup. For
likewise, I think in your book you mentioned the same effect, only with a dry fly. Just place it on top rather than trying to cast it in.
Right.
So the secret is getting close and personal and try not to be discovered.
And we, you know, the waters in New Mexico are kind of small, so that's kind of and broken and require short cast. And we get fishermen, we get an awful lot of fishermen from Colorado who fish bigger water, and it's a huge chore of ours to get them to shorten up and fish a less line, and it's immensely important to get people to use the minimum amount of line they can. And so often we fish with people that it's either catching more fish or you know, liking your casting along. But usually the better the fisherman, the shorter the line.
Okay. Dennis in San Francisco wrote in. He says, Taylor, I prefer to swing flies over all other fishing techniques. I just find it much more enjoyable method of fishing as opposed to nymphing. For me, the tug is the drug when fishing. Can you let me know what you think about this form of fishing for trout in most situations? I've had pretty good results so far, but I realize that I might be catching less fish. But is really that significant, or are there other variations of swinging flies to increase my odds?
I have a chapter called The Swing in here. If I'd have thought of that, the tug is the drug, I would have put that in here. That's pretty good.
That's a good line, huh?
he should write a book, yeah. And here's something that I think is appropriate. I suspect that swinging flies works well where the trout eats stuff that swims, minnows, sculpins, crayfish. And in Argentina, the pancura, which is like a crayfish. Swinging is also a great way to fish when the water is high or the fish aren't feeding. This style of fishing seems to work best on gullible trout. Swinging often produces a lot more action than fish because the fly interests trout that either don't eat or strike short behind the fly. But as a lot of water gets covered and a lot of fish get to see the fly, plenty of them will end up caught. And Argentina is a great example for that, because when I first started fishing in Argentina over 20 years ago, the fish were much more gullible than they are, say, now. And you could catch a lot more big fish swinging the fly than you can now. Now you have to fish more upstream with a nymph to get the big numbers of fish. But another thing that comes into play here is just the nature of the water. When I look, when I'm guiding, and I've got somebody that doesn't strike fast with a nymph, I think about where I can take them that has a nice, even riffle where they can swing the fly and they'll hook the fish. So I think a lot of it is that you come into, and I know he's calling from where on the northwest, and that's a whole different world than I know, and I think they've got a lot more water that's appropriate for swinging the fly. But a nice even current is, I think, really what makes that work. You know, as soon as it starts to get broken, then your swing is kind of fouled, you know, and
yeah,
it's not
yeah.
working.
Running out of time here, and I have one more question to run by you before we close things off here. But I just want to mention to Dennis, too, that we did a show with Davey Wanton, who's like the master of wet fly techniques, so he might want to check that show out on wet fly techniques, where we spend a whole show talking about that. So,
Davey
Wanton,
I have to interject that Davey was my son's coach on the United States Junior Fly Fishing Team. When they placed second in the world in Wales I don't know what year that was, about 12 years ago.
Oh, very cool. Yeah, because Davey's from the UK. Yeah, Yeah. Uh-huh. And I think they do a lot more wet fly fishing over there.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, final question. I have to make it quick here because we're way over time, but we're having such a good time here, I lost track of time. Joe in Austin, Texas asks, he says, I enjoy all your publications I've read so far. The biggest struggle that I have with catching large trout is successfully landing them on a size 20 or smaller hook. Is there a strategy that you would recommend?
Well, I think that softer rods, I know on the San Juan, some of that old Sage light line or, you know, some of these really soft rods seem to work well. And certainly staying abreast of the fish. And one thing that just sounds like too simple is paying attention. All the time, you know, when we have somebody hook a big fish, what I don't want to talk to them too much. I don't want them to turn their head and look at me and smile, or I want them to pay attention and really be on top of it, because we got a lot of human error there, you know, and the big and with that small fly, you just don't, you want to keep the pressure real even and never go over that. Know what you can get away with, because it's the hook coming out and or wearing out in that tiny little purchase it's got, you know. So really being patient, I guess is the word.
The secret, helps. Huh? Light and patient, huh?
Yeah, I think
light
so.
Light touch. Okay. Okay. Well, time to close things off. And we need to get into our drawings here. And tonight we're giving away 1-year membership to Federation of Fly Fishers and a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. And also a copy of your book, Taylor, Instinctive Fly Fishing, the second edition. So courtesy Lions Press, which we appreciate them helping us with that gift. So let's get right to that. And but just a quick reminder, everybody, before you leave the website tonight, take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show. It says, what do you think of the show? Just click on that link and leave us your comments. We'd really appreciate it. So let's give away a few things here, Taylor. These drawings we do are randomly selected from our show's registration base, so if you folks didn't register tonight, it's too late now, but make sure you do for our next show, because it gives you a chance to win one of these great prizes. If you are the lucky winner, we will contact you after the show by email and get your information that we need to get you your prize. So the first thing we're giving away is 1-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And if you want to learn more about the Federation, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org. It's a great organization to support, and you'll a chance to learn a lot and be involved with a lot of great people. And our winner there is Wayne Bernal. Wayne Bernal. I'm not sure what state he's in. It says U.S. But Wayne, congratulations on winning that 1-year membership. And if you already have one, we'll get that extended for you. Fly Fusion is the next thing we're giving away, a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. If you want to find out more about Fly Fusion, go to flyfusionmag.com, flyfusionmag.com, a great magazine to read and learn a lot from. And our winner for that is Warren Davis in Ohio, Warren Davis. So congratulations, Warren, on winning that 1-year subscription. So now we've got our drawings done. Now we give away Taylor's book. So okay, here's my question. This isn't going to be hard, but just to make sure you were listening, but we'll make it kind of easy tonight. This is requires 2 answers, but we talked about the San Juan worm. What is that? What can that be used to simulate? There's 2 kinds of worms that could be used to simulate that Taylor talked about tonight. So give me your answer. What are those 2? Natural worms, the names of them that that could be used to, as a fly for. So Taylor, I'm sitting here pressing a button, and we have, okay, our first answer is earthworms and aquatic worms. Did he get it right?
That's about all I know. Yeah, I'm sure there's a more scientific answer. But
no,
yeah.
That's what I was looking for. That was good enough. So
right.
Dean Wormell in Westford, Massachusetts, just won your book, Taylor. So congratulations to Dean. And he types fast too. He even spelled it all right.
Yeah, he does. He can type in towelsflyshot.com and send it and get the address and send it to me, and I'll sign it and send it back.
Oh, okay. If you'd like to do that, yeah, or just come out and go fishing with you, right?
There you go. Uh-huh.
That's a way to get it done too. So, Dean, send me your in the same box. Send me your mailing address, and what I can do, you know, because I have this book here this time, which I usually don't do. What I will do, Dean, is send me your address, and I'll send your address down to along with the book down to Taylor, and then have him send it to you. Is that okay, Taylor?
You bet.
And then you can sign it that way, and that'd be
there
great.
You go.
So just give me that information in the same text box, Dean, or send it to info@askaboutflyfishing.com. info@askaboutflyfishing.com. Terrific. Well, Taylor, thanks for being with us tonight. It was lots of fun. I learned a lot, as I always do when with my guests, and I had a great time talking to you. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, it was a lot of very intelligent questions. It was fun.
Well, we've got a lot of smart fishermen out there, I'll tell you. So they always challenge us, so that's great.
Well, I had an answer for everything. I don't know
if it was the right answer either. So
at least I wrote it down in my book, so it makes people believe it more.
Yeah. There we go. Well, everybody, before we leave tonight, I just wanted to remind you to go in our archive and look for shows that interest you. It's just like tonight we talked about wet fly fishing and fish food, great shows we did. Go out and take a look. We've got over 155 shows in the archive. I'm sure there's an interest for you. Just go in there, type in a keyword phrase like fish or trout, tarpon, Madison River, San Juan River, and I'm sure you'll find a show that'll interest you. Our next broadcast is going to be on December 19th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern, and on that show we'll be interviewing Tom Larimer, and our topic for the show will be the Deschutes, Rainbows and Steelhead, the Deschutes River. Tom Larimer is an experienced guide whose passion for steelhead is only equaled by his love for trout. So listen in to hear Tom share his secrets about fly fishing the Deschutes River for both steelhead and trout. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Royal Gorge Anglers, Keeney's Fly Shop, and Women's Fly Fishing Alaska for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. That's 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. We'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.